This is Spectrum.
Alternative myth, homeopathy, secret society, hypnosis, the paranormal, alternative energy, UFO abduction, the weird, the wild, and the wonderful.
With your hosts, Tom Theophanis and Scott Jordan.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to the Spectrum Radio Network on BBS Radio 2. I'm Scott Jordan, here with my co-host, Tom Theophanis, and remember, there's no such thing as too much information. Hey, Tom, how you doing, buddy?
Hey, Scott. I'm good. How you doing?
I'm doing good. It's been a little nutty lately. Been busy rebuilding getting the new system up and running since the last system, computer system, yep. My main system for doing the show, died dead on a doornail. We got a very interesting guest tonight, Richard Dolan.
Yes, we do.
Just a little information on Richard. Richard Dolan is among the world's most prominent UFO researchers and is considered by many to be the world's preeminent historian on the subject. He is the author of two volumes of UFO history, UFOs in the National Security State, as well as an analysis of the future, AD, After Disclosure, The People's Guide to Life After Contact. He's a regular guest on Coast to Coast AM radio and has appeared on many television specials for the History Channel, Sci-Fi, BBC, and elsewhere. Richard is currently writing another groundbreaking work on UFOs called UFOs for the 21st Century Mind, due out mid-2012. It offers a fresh analysis of the ancient phenomenon, one that speaks to a world in the midst of social and technological transformation and promises to redefine ufology in many important ways.
So let's welcome Richard to the show. Hey, Richard.
Hey, Richard. How you doing?
Hello, gentlemen. Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Glad to have you on the show. Okay, well, I seen a video on YouTube of you discussing the secret space program. I want to sort of focus on that, as well as maybe some hints about your new book and talking about that. But for now, I want to focus on the secret space program.
I'd be happy to. This has been a topic I've been interested in, I think, increasingly over the last few years. I've had a long exploration into this field of UFOs and the cover-up associated with it, and it's taken me, I would say, quite a few years to get to this point. My thesis right now, and I'll try to explain this as best as I can, is simply that there is probably a high degree of probability a secret clandestine space program run in connection with the U.S. military structure somehow, with black budget money, that is using technology that's significantly in advance of what we officially are supposed to have. So that's my basic assessment. And one thing I don't try to argue is that I know this for an absolute fact. Instead, I try to put this together as a best working hypothesis at this point. I do say this because of a number of factors. One, the long nature of the UFO cover-up itself, which I am convinced includes the recovery of exotic technology that was not from our civilization to begin with. That is, I believe, it's extraterrestrial. And that this technology and the science around it has been instrumental in developing a secret space program with black budget money. Another reason I believe this is simply because of the quality of some of the leaks that have come out that deal with space anomalies and lunar anomalies, that is, on the moon, specifically the idea of structures on the moon itself, which, as we all know, are not supposed to exist, and yet they appear that they do seem to exist. And then finally, I work on the idea that, or rather the evidence of really odd anomalies in Earth orbit and beyond Earth orbit that have been tracked by astronauts, cosmonauts, NASA video, and so on. A lot of things that we consider to be anomalies in space are not true anomalies. They actually do have ice crystals that look very odd and can fool a person. On the other hand, there are other things out there that I just can't see any realistic explanation for, other than that they're something that's just not supposed to exist. So when I look at all of these factors, and combining that with my assessment of where the clandestine technology program is at, yes, I conclude that we have a secret space program.
And you're also, with that, you're not saying that any of this anomalous UFOs are 100% made by humans, and that would cover the whole UFO question.
Right, I'm not saying that. Absolutely, I'm not saying that. And the reason that I don't believe that is when you go through this phenomenon far back enough in time, you find the exact same types of performance. So the question is, if we're making our own UFOs, when did we begin? You know, about 5-6 years ago, I was researching in the Canadian National Archives up in Ottawa. I'm an American, but I can go up to Canada for research, and I was in Ottawa.
Yes, we welcome back. You.
I'm very glad for that. In 05, I spent 3 full days in those archives going through citizen UFO reports that were sent into the Canadian government. They're quite interesting. One, for example, and there are actually several of these, but one in particular stood out. That was a retrospective of a sighting that took place in 1936 in the Northwest Territory by a gentleman who was very elderly at the time that he wrote this letter. He was a very meticulous man, just judging by the letter, judging by his handwriting, which I was able to look at. He submitted his service record to the government to just prove who he was and so forth. And his story was that back in 1936, when he was 25 years old, he was engaged in aerial mapping operations for the Canadian government, presumably of all of that massive amount of land up there that needed accurate mapping.
Yeah.
So he was one of these guys up there, and he was in the Northwest Territory above the tree line, so there's no growth up where he was. He was at a place called, I believe it's pronounced Aylmer Lake, A-Y-L-M-E-R. Well, I looked this place up. There's nothing there even today, let alone in 1936, hundreds of miles around where this guy was. So he had one of those neat aircraft that could land on the water. And he said at that moment, it was in the middle of a perfectly blue, crystal blue sky, perfect afternoon. I was doing some preventative maintenance on my aircraft, and I just happened to look up, he said, and when I did so, I saw the most beautiful object in the sky I've ever seen. It was slightly oblong in shape, he said, and he watched it turn very suddenly, and then he watched it just take off instantaneously, and within, he said, 2 seconds, it was at the horizon. It was just gone, never made a sound. He had a few other things to say about it in terms of the detail of the sighting. But essentially, this man saw, in truly the middle of nowhere, 1936, what we can only say would be a UFO of exceptional performance. Now, there are people who have argued that the UFO phenomenon is, the true UFO phenomenon is simply classified experimental technology. And it's stories like this that I keep coming back to that make me shake my head and say, I don't think so. Certainly there are experimental craft that exist in the black budget world that are really phenomenal. There's no question in my mind that that's the case. But can we really say this about events that took place in the 1930s or prior? And I just have to think the answer is no. There's no evidence for any type of breakthroughs of this sort, none that I've come across. So, and then the other aspect of it is you have so much true high strangeness connected with so many UFO encounters. And that includes, of course, alleged sightings of non-human beings, alien beings, of a variety of appearances. That includes what we would call abduction experiences and other types of encounters. And even beyond that, a lot of what I would just consider to be bizarre maybe paranormal is almost the right word for this. But in other words, that there's an intelligence on an order of magnitude beyond what we are ordinarily dealing with. So no, I'm not inclined at all to explain the bulk of the UFO phenomenon to classified technology, although that's a real factor. It's something that has to be considered. It does muddy the waters. If we were to look up in the sky and see an absolutely perfect triangle or an oval-shaped object hover and then take off instantly, we might wonder if this is a classified experimental or classified operational technology. And we might be justified to think that. But 50, 60 years ago, 70 years ago, I'm thinking no.
Yeah. It just doesn't make sense, does it? And added to that, there's artwork that's out there that has paintings of UFOs in the artwork, and there's cave drawings and all kinds of other evidence out there that you can connect to this.
Well, exactly. You go back. You really want to take this back to some of the early cave paintings. Now, some of those are a little bit problematic as evidence. We have to really state this clearly. First of all, any of the cave art that we look at as evidence, it's not the same as writing. So
it's interpretive.
We have to interpret what we see. However, there are some very, very odd and unusual and provocative types of artwork, for sure. My personal favorite, I would say, would be the Australian Aborigine tribe, Australian Aborigines, who depicted beings 5,000 years ago in caves in Kimberley, Australia, of beings that they call the Vwajina. And these are sky beings. And if you look at the images of these Vwajina, which are readily available on any web search, they certainly don't look like Aborigines. If they look like anything, they look like modern depictions of grays. And yet, what the heck are these things doing in cave paintings on the other side of the world 5,000 years ago? And there's really no explanation for that, except that according to the Aborigine tradition, these creatures had control, mastery over space and time, and that one of them, in fact, became the Milky Way. So there's a connection of these beings with the sky and with control over important things, including weather, I think was another thing they controlled. And so what we have are suggestive stories, not quite the same as true evidence, but certainly enough to keep you scratching your head. And then there are some good stories, indeed, going back thousands of years. The difference between then and now is simply that back in the earlier eras, no one was really doing proper investigations. So what we have, and you could go back into the Egyptian annals or the Roman records early medieval Europe and so on, and you would get very interesting stories. And that's really all that they are. They just remain stories. They're fascinating. They describe, for example, balls of fire maneuvering or seeming to maneuver in the sky, coming here, going away, coming back, going away. Beings that were said to descend from the sky, you get that sometimes. So they're interesting. But again, no one doing a kind of methodical investigation where numbers of witnesses are interviewed, and some type of determination is made. That doesn't happen really till 20th century.
Yeah, you get some of the early newspapers from the Old West that have reports of unusual sightings in the sky.
That's right. That's right. You get these in American and certainly Canadian newspapers going right through the history of very odd things that have been seen. So it's enough to make you make me think that yes, I think we've got a case here. And I am inclined to accept the UFO phenomenon, if we can call it that loosely, as something that goes back probably throughout our whole history. I think that we're right to assume that there's an ancient alien phenomenon. The problem that we simply have is I don't know if we'll ever get to the point where we really have a true answer to the gaping hole in our history that goes way back. I think there's a lot of mysteries we may not really ever truly resolve, but I do think that this is likely. that there have been other entities that have been here with us and have interacted with us in some way.
Okay. Tom, do you have a question?
In your mind, Richard, do you think that this phenomenon that we're dealing with, is it a nuts and bolts type phenomenon, or is it more bizarre than that, or more...
Yeah, that's a good question. when I started in this game about 15, 20 years ago, my overriding assumption was that that it was a nuts and bolts phenomenon, and that's how I was going to treat it, and that's just how it was. And I almost dogmatically, I say almost because I wasn't ever quite dogmatist on this, but almost dogmatically really worked on that assumption that I didn't want to get into any of the weird stuff. Well, that's kind of funny when I look back on that. This is nothing if not weird, this field, and it just keeps drawing you further and further into paradigm-shattering beliefs. So I'm at the point now where, look, certainly a lot of the evidence that we have available to us in the form of reports, and that includes military reports, as well as the ground trace evidence from occasional landed vehicles that we have access to, and other forms of physical contact tell me that we're dealing with something that is material, something that is physical, something that does, in fact, go through our atmosphere in a material way. So in that sense, it is a nuts and bolts phenomenon, yes. But the problem is that it's a nuts and bolts phenomenon that seems to have some kind of control over space and time. Just like the Australian Aborigines would say of the Wajina, these modern UFOs, if they're ET, I still think that's a reasonable assumption, but whatever they are, they have some level of control over what we would call space-time reality. So, for example, they have the ability, seemingly, to blip into and out of this reality, this physical reality that we inhabit. They seem to have the ability to go through solid objects like walls. If you at least go through the abduction literature, and it's easy to make that conclusion. How they do it, I don't know. So there's something much greater than a nuts and bolts phenomenon here. And then, of course, there's the inevitable question as to what, you know, whatever these beings are they related to the gods and angels and demons of human history? Is that what we have actually been dealing with? And that's a totally valid question. And I think that, yes, they probably do have a relationship. So really, what are we dealing with here? Well, it's still something I haven't figured out.
One of the reasons I asked that question was because in quite a number of cases that I was involved with over the years, and I'm sure you heard of many, you know, where they, you know, somebody may see what seems to be a nuts and bolts type object doing whatever maneuvering and such, and yet people around them, or, you know, people that should be seeing it as well, do not.
Yes.
How does that work?
Well, it's something that, right, has the appearance of being selective to some witnesses.
Yes.
But that's sometimes, and at other times that's not the case. It's not always so that...
No, it's not always, you know, but I said it does occur.
And it's damned puzzling. So the question, you know, I'll just tell you, I've had on two occasions in my life what I would call a UFO sighting. And on both of those occasions, I had a distinct feeling. And all I can say is it's a feeling that the object I was observing somehow knew I was observing it and was there for my benefit or for my edification one way or another. And I'll tell them to you. They're not that long to tell.
Yeah.
And this is related, I think, really to what you're talking about. The first occasion, this is back in 1999, my son, who's now almost 16, he was 3 years old at the time, and I was holding his hand and walking back from the corner of where we live, right in front of my house, and I'm here in Rochester, New York, on a beautiful May afternoon. And unusually for Rochester, there was not one cloud in the sky. We have a very cloudy city, but not on that day. The other thing that's relevant in this is that I live right by Rochester International Airport. I see aircraft every single day when I'm out. So on this particular afternoon, I'm walking with my son, and this bright flash catches my attention in the sky. So I stop to look at it, and what I see is truly the brightest object I had ever seen in my life in the sky other than the sun. So this thing was incredibly reflective, I thought. And my initial instinct was to say, wow, that's the most reflective object in the sky I have ever seen. And for whatever reason, it's shining right at my eyes. Mm. Wow, what is that? I want to see what that thing looks like, because all I could see was this intensely bright light up in the sky at the height of altitude of a normal flying aircraft. That's I would estimate from 10 to 20,000 feet. So it was up there, but not super high up there either. So I'm watching this thing, waiting to see a shape, and I couldn't see a shape, and I couldn't even tell if it was moving. I thought it was moving, but sometimes, of course, it's hard to tell, depending on the angle. So I just stood there waiting. But now my problem was that my son, my poor son, who was 3 years old, was wondering what has happened to his poor dad, who's like stood there like a statue on the sidewalk looking up at the sky. And I heard him calling me, asking me what's wrong. And I thought, oh, I have to calm him down, because he's starting to get upset. But I don't want to take my eyes off it. And here's where I thought this thing got into my head. Because the thought came into my head, if you turn away from this, you'll never see it again. And it's a thought that made no sense at all, because really, where could it go? No clouds. If it had lost its reflectivity, I would have had no problem being able to see this thing. It wasn't so high up in the sky. Ask yourself, how difficult is it to see an airplane going across the sky? And yet I had this idea, don't look away, don't look away, don't look away. But my son, I had to look at him. So I actually took my left arm and pointed at this object like I was holding its place. No kidding. And for 1 second, I turned to my son. 1 second later, I turned back, and that thing, of course, was gone. I mean, just gone. And I spent the next 5 minutes pouring over the sky and did not find it. I had one other less dramatic but interesting one. A number of years later, I was walking with our family dog in the early evening with my wife and my daughter, who was about 8 years old at the time. My son was out with some friends, I think. And it was an early evening, very thin cloud cover, and I just said, hey, wouldn't it be cool if we looked up and saw a UFO? So my daughter and I both looked up, and immediately we saw this object booking across the sky. No airplane could go this fast, I'll tell you right now. Now, I guess you could say it might have been a shooting star or meteorite, but here's the problem. This thing went right into a very thin patch of cloud, and it just never came out. So it went in, and that was that. My daughter, who was a little younger than she is now, got nervous. She got scared, and I remembered having to calm her down and saying, no, it's just a meteorite. But I don't think so. I don't know what that thing was. If it's a meteorite, that's some coincidence, and that it just happened when we looked up, and that it just went into the cloud and never came out.
Yeah, I think a lot of these things that happen, you pretty much just have to file them in the I don't know file. I don't know.
Yeah, right.
I want to tell you guys a couple of stories, and this is going back in the early to mid-90s. I received a call from a gentleman out in Pickering. Pickering is about, just a little bit east of Toronto. This gentleman lived right down by the lake. And the 401, which is the major highway up here in Toronto, is fairly close to the lake, so you can see it from apparently this fellow's house. The time was when our Toronto exhibition was on, and during that period, towards the end of the exhibition, the last, I think, 3 days is when they have the air show. And it just happened to be in one of those days where, they'll have all kinds of different planes flying around. And, you know, it's not unusual that you'll see, you know, some of the bigger planes as well. Anyway, we got a call from this gentleman. He said he had a very strange situation that occurred to him. Him and his son was outside in the yard, and they were cutting the grass. It was probably around lunchtime. But for some reason, he said he was, all of a sudden, he became awfully quiet. And because the highway is not very far, you know, you hear the cars going by and such. But he says his whole neighborhood, he couldn't see nobody. Nobody was outside. You know, there was no bird sounds. And this awfully quiet all of a sudden. And then they saw this humongous triangular object or plane or whatever you want to call it. But flying so low to the ground with no sound. Right? It was like,
right.
He says it was, they couldn't have been any more than maybe, you know, 200-300 feet high.
Something you could actually throw a stone at. You could actually hit it with a rock.
You can almost throw, yeah, you can throw a stone at it. Because in actuality, he claimed that he could see the rivets on this thing, and he could see the pilot.
That's a good sighting.
Right?
He saw the
and
pilot.
This thing was silent. Yeah, well, he saw a guy inside, you know, like, you know, the pilot, you know, the like an army-type pilot, right? So he thought it was one of the, you know, the big, you know, triangular planes that, you know, in those days they were just starting out. And, you know, he thought, but it was weird because there was no engine. This thing was going to be so slow and so low, you know, you'd have to hear something, right? But he said it was like gliding.
Now, you said this was in the early 90s, did you say, I believe?
Yeah.
Did I hear right?
Okay.
Yeah,
that's when he was the director of MOOP on Ontario.
Anyway, so this thing flew over the lake, right, and it just, you know, went off on the horizon. And, you know, it never made the circle that, you know, assuming it was part of the air show. And so I thought, okay, that's pretty weird.
You know? Oh, yeah.
And there was no neighbors, and I said, you know, I mean, obviously, this thing flying over the 401, there would have been, you know, literally thousands of people that would have been able to see it, right? And if it was flying that low. So anyway, I didn't know what to do with it. You know, I took all the information. The young fella even drew exactly what his father drew, and, you know, we just kind of, like, filed it in this weird file. About, I'd say, I don't know, a week or two later, I receive a call from Bell Canada, and the operator tells me that on the other line, you have a deaf-mute individual, a lady, who wanted to report, you know, a strange object that she saw downtown. And, you know, she has to type the information to the Bell person, and, you know, she would relay back the message. Anyway, this lady was waiting on a bus stop down by Danforth and Broadview, which is, you know, pretty much in the middle of Toronto, downtown. And she was waiting at the bus stop, and there was this other Chinese lady with her over there. And she kind of looked up, and she saw this triangular object again, flying extremely low, that it almost hit a church steeple, right? Humongous thing.
Right.
She said, and she could see rivets, she could see the hole, and the pilot. same
she
exact description the other fellow was giving.
Now, can I just ask?
Yeah, she could see the pilot, she could see, yeah.
Was this the perfect triangle, or was it an unusually shaped type of thing? I mean, what could she give you an idea of how?
Pretty much a triangular. Yeah, just a triangular, big black triangular.
It's silent. It's a big black silent triangle, yeah.
Silent, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, of course, she was deaf-mute, so she couldn't have told if it was, you know, if it had noise or anything, right?
Right,
but
right.
She, you know, she thought it was unusual that this lady that was with her in the bus stop wasn't looking up, right? So she kind of, like, nudged her and said, you know, pointed, you know, to the sky and said, you know, do you see this thing, right? And the other lady obviously was not seeing it, even though it was just, you know, sort of going overhead. And it was, a weird situation where you have, you know, two individuals or actually three in this case, that saw this object, but nobody else was seeing it. And again, this is downtown Toronto. This thing was going over,
right.
The traffic and, thousands of people are literally there. So, but there was nobody else that seemed to have noticed it.
Well, it makes me wonder if there's a kind of shielding, a visual shielding that these objects employ that mostly works, but maybe somehow doesn't always work. I've often wondered if, in fact, over our heads there's a tremendous amount of traffic going on all the time, but that we're somehow shielded from it visually and maybe in other ways of instrumentation because they simply know how to cloak themselves, so to speak, but that occasionally there are glitches or somehow because everyone's different, there might be some people who are a little bit better able to detect this than others. It's just a thought.
Maybe their brains are just wired differently. I mean, we're all individuals.
Right, exactly. So I've often wondered this. Those are two fascinating stories. The fact that these people saw the pilot. Now, I wonder how they were able to see the pilot because, presumably they're seeing the bottom of the craft. Maybe they could see the pilot on approach.
No, because they would see, like, the cockpit as well because it was so low. It was like, they could see, coming, and because it was slow,
right?
They can basically see the whole thing.
Well, yeah, that would certainly indicate that we're flying our own triangles. I spoke to a Canadian witness a number of years ago who saw an object not too far from Kingston out on the road. In fact, I drove up there to go to the exact location. I got to know this witness very well subsequently. She's a woman, one of the most upright, conscientious people I think I've ever met, and described this absolutely perfect triangle, black triangle, with sharp corners, in fact, come up. And then, it's not far from a Canadian air base, actually, over in Kingston. But whether that was connected to it is, she didn't really have any clarity if it was, but this was another perfect triangle. She did not see a pilot, but Canada's got them, just as the States have got them. Those are the two areas where you see a lot of sightings.
And now, are we talking specifically about something called TR-3B? It's been given multiple names, the flying triangle, the TR-3B.
Right.
A witness came out in the 80s, a military man, in the Air Force and talked about the TR-3Bs, first broke the story originally, Edgar Fouché talked about it back then, and then he just sort of dropped off the radar. So
yeah, I think sometimes known as the Black Man, and most definitely I think that that's one of the things that we're dealing with. I definitely believe that.
Well, I mean, assuming that it was, let's say one of our own, even, we have something technological, thing of that quality, but, the way it was performing didn't seem right. There was, a more anomalous situation occurring in those type of cases where, it's not just like a fast or doing maneuvers and that sort of thing.
Well, here's a question that I have. We started off talking about thoughts on the secret space program, and this is one reason why I think that we do have one. Because let's assume that some of these pilots are human, that they're part of some presumably black budget type of operation. So then the question is, well, what the heck are they doing? What is their mission? They're certainly not being seen in any kind of theater of war. You look at the two major wars the United States has fought over the last decade in Iraq and Afghanistan, and considering how much they have bled my country's treasury dry, one might have thought that they would come in mighty handy.
Yeah, that's a good question.
And yet there's no evidence that they have been used. So if we're flying these things, they've got to be expensive. Where the heck are they being used? And my reasoning for why I think they're part of a space program, it's a little bit based on an analogy. If you go back about 25 years, 1986, the United States bombed Libya. People around back then recall that. It was an interesting engagement because the U.S. did not use its top fighter aircraft of the day, its top fighter aircraft being the newly operational but still secret stealth fighter. That is the F-117A Nighthawk. And it wasn't used because its existence was considered so classified, so important, that it could not be used for such a low-level mission as bombing Libya. And so instead the U.S. used F-111 aircraft, which are very fine aircraft, but didn't actually kill Gaddafi, which was part of the U.S. goal. So in a sense you could say they failed. So the question is, well, so we have an example, I guess, of top operational aircraft not being used for a mission because essentially their classification was too high for that. So now let's look at these triangles, or maybe there are even other types of aircraft that are being flown covertly. They're not being used in standard geopolitical military engagements. We might ask why, and the answer, I think, presents itself, which is that their classification is too high for that, and they are used for something considered to be much more important, and that much more important thing, presumably, would be dealing with these others, these other beings, whatever they are.
The point of view of interaction.
Correct. There's a UFO phenomenon. It's real. There's a lot of things I don't know, but one thing I do know very confidently is that there is a phenomenon that the U.S. and other militaries have engaged in for 60-plus years now, since the end of World War II. Objects have invaded sensitive airspace. They have forced the scrambling of jet interceptors on many occasions. Interceptors have said again and again these objects outclass them over and over. So someone has got something that is not supposed to exist. And so when I look at these objects that we seem to be flying, that seems to be it. The answer is that their job is to deal with that. Now, whether that means in a confrontational, mm-hmm. hostile way or not, I don't know.
We don't know what the level of interaction is, whether, you know, what's going on.
Right. I do not know. All that I can tell you is what some people who allege to have been insiders have said to me. And I take all of that with a grain of salt, no matter how detailed some of it has been. And some of it has been very detailed. But that doesn't mean that I simply believe it all and repeat it. But I do have the opinion that, yes, there is a deeply clandestine component of the black budget world that does, their job is to interact with and deal with the presence of these other entities that are here on planet Earth. That's their job. And my suspicion is that some of these aircraft, whether there's a real TR-3A or TR-3B or something else like it, that that's what their mission is. And that, therefore, they cannot reveal the existence of these aircraft because that would give the game away to the rest of the world, which these people are not willing to do.
Mm. Well, I mean, we have people like former astronauts talking about UFOs and coming out and talking about it. So, I mean, it goes all the way up the chain, doesn't it?
Yes, well, I've spoken on a number of occasions with former astronaut Edgar Mitchell, who is really one of the greatest gifts to the modern world that I can possibly imagine. This man was an Apollo 14 astronaut. He went to the moon. He was the sixth man to go to the moon, officially, unless there was a black program to go into the moon. But Edgar Mitchell is a man that I've gotten to know a little bit, and we like each other, and I've been lucky in that I've been able to talk to him about a few of these things. One thing that he had said for a good 10-year stretch, and he said to me personally, he doesn't say this anymore, but he did say it, was that he had two ultra-elite contacts within the national security world that confirmed to him the existence of extraterrestrial technology and bodies that were in the possession of deeply clandestine agencies. And a few years ago, I asked him if he would help me out in my own research, not by giving these names away, who these people were, but essentially by throwing me a bone of some sort and pointing me in a direction that might be fruitful, whatever he might be able to say. And his answer was, I really can't do that. He said, the people who came to me when they did so at great risk, professionally, personally, and risk to their families. And he said, I cannot put them in danger until after they passed away. I can't reveal who they are. So it's a serious issue, and he doesn't bring that up anymore. I haven't heard him mention that really since, I think, 2008 or so, and I think he then kind of stopped mentioning. And now what Edgar Mitchell will say, and it's still very useful, is simply that he's spoken to people who said this and that to him, and that he knows it's a real phenomenon, but he's gotten a little bit less specific.
Ah, okay. And former astronaut Gordon Cooper, of course, came out and told his story.
Yes, indeed. Gordon Cooper, while he was a pilot with the U.S. Air Force, on more than one occasion saw what we could call a UFO. In one case, he encountered it directly while he was flying over in Germany. And in the other instance, over by Edwards Air Force Base, where he... I don't believe he was a direct witness to the object, but he saw a film that was brought to him, and he was able to study the film and then described how that film was confiscated by guys in dark suits, and that was the end of that.
Yeah. So, I mean, the information's definitely out there. A lot of this stuff relegated to special access programs and stuff like that. And you talk a little bit about that in your lecture. Can you tell us a little bit about the secrecy iceberg?
Yes, for sure. You know, in the world of research, anyone such as myself or any other researcher who's trying to get valid information about the world that we live in, we, of course, are limited to public or open sources. Now, you go to your library, or you can go to your government archives, and you can have access to thousands and indeed millions of pages of information. So there's certainly a lot out there. But what's interesting is that we don't really know what the percentage is, but there's a very good chance that more than half of all U.S. government documents that exist are classified in one form or another, which would mean simply that on one level you could say with justice that most of your government's activities and history is secret. So, you know, you've got your public open sources, and I liken this to an iceberg, where the vast bulk of the mass of an iceberg, of course, is below the water, and so too when you're looking at the classified world. Above the water, we have public or open sources. We have also documents that were once classified, but that have become declassified. At the surface of the water, that's still valid for you to get, but very difficult, would be documents or sources that we call unclassified. And unclassified simply means, yes, you can read it, you're allowed to.
Can you tell us about the secrecy iceberg?
Sure. I liken the world of secrecy, not just regarding UFOs, but really government secrecy of all types, to an iceberg. And whereas in an ordinary iceberg, of course, we know that the vast bulk of the mass is below the water, so too, really, with documents and secrecy and so on. So, for example, as a researcher, I myself or any other researchers who are trying to learn about the history of their government, public sources are things like in libraries or in archives where you have access to thousands and indeed millions of pages of documents, and there's certainly a lot there. But actually, we don't really know the percentage, but there is a very good case to be made for the fact that in the U.S., more than half of all U.S. government documents are classified in one form or another. So on that basis, you could say more than half of my government's history and activities are secret from me. Now, again, we don't know what that percentage is, but there have been a number of estimates, and it's certainly a very high amount. So you've got public and open sources, and then you have sources that were once classified that have become declassified, and those are fair game for a guy like myself. And then at the level of the water, so to speak, would be a classification known as unclassified, where it's technically legal for me to read these things, but just try to find them. An unclassified document might be, you know, one of five copies that was printed in some obscure government printing office that, for all intents and purposes, is unreachable for most ordinary people. So then you go below the water, and these are the documents that are classified. You've got levels like confidential, and then further down into the water, you've got secret, and then you've got top secret. And top secret isn't all one piece either. You've got top secret sensitive compartmented information, or TSSCI. You have other types of deeply top secret programs, like special access programs. That is the primordial black budget programs. Then you have special access programs that are unacknowledged, that is USAPs. An unacknowledged special access program officially doesn't exist, except for the fact that it does exist. And there are even a variety of other designations that I have come across within the classified world describing other types of special access programs or types of black budget programs. And then beyond that,
right. That's
just the world of government and the military. You've got the world of private contractors and private cliques, if we can say. Look, there's a lot of private money that is behind the public, behind public power in the U.S. and everywhere. I don't think there's a country that's immune to this. And within the U.S. system, we know for sure that private contractors have become, over the years, really the dominant hand in the military-industrial partnership, so that there's a great deal of independence of action among these private contractors. And the fact is that in a lot of those circles, information isn't so much classified as it has become proprietary,
right. Which
makes it even more impervious to public inquiry. And then, of course, at the bottom of the iceberg, let us not forget the group that I call them, whoever these mm-hmm. other beings are, whether singular or plural, whether one type or many, whether their intentions are beneficial to us or not, they haven't been announcing themselves very publicly.
Right.
And so they are still very much an enigma to us. So there's these many layers of secrecy, these many layers of not knowing. Maybe not knowing isn't the right word, because certainly leaks come out, claims come out all the time. The problem that a guy like myself has, or any other responsible researcher has, is in how to evaluate these sources. If something is coming out as in the form of a leak, being able to confirm that is sometimes very difficult and sometimes impossible to do.
Right. And these levels... all these various levels, when we're talking about secret and classified and top secret, they fall within the top secret. Like, top secret is a classification, and a lot of the different programs fall within top secret laterally. Not above
right. Top
secret, but laterally, they're lateral terms. You know what I mean, right?
Right. There are claims, and there's actually been quite a few claims that there are classifications above top secret. But certainly within the top secret classification, there's more than enough capability to maintain a tight, tight level of secrecy.
Right.
I mean, everything comes down to what's called compartmentation. You and I could have top secret clearances, but with absolutely no knowledge of what the other guy's doing, and even though we could be buddies for 20 years, it wouldn't matter. I wouldn't share with you. You wouldn't share with me. We would both understand that. And that's just how it goes. And that's the rule. That's how it is across the board. So, look, you can tighten things up very, very significantly with a top secret classification. But my point simply is that, A, there is a great deal of classified information that we are not having access to, particularly regarding the UFO topic, and that there are deeper and deeper layers even beyond top secret, as I mentioned, with the private contractors right. and so forth being one. So we're dealing with a very difficult nut to crack in terms of official acknowledgement. And I would point out that of the thousands, and there are several thousand pages of documents pertaining to UFOs that have been released by the U.S. government over the years, mostly during the 1970s when the Freedom of Information Act had its real heyday.
Yeah.
But even so, of all of those documents, only the smallest handful were ever of the top secret designation. Most were of a lower level of secrecy.
Classified,
or not,
yeah.
Right. They were confidential or secret. The ones that are top secret are nearly all redacted or blacked out. You can't read almost anything on them. And that's only been a few. So in other words, of a top secret level in terms of UFO documents, nothing official has been released. Now, there's been leaked documents that have been of the top secret level, and they're disputed. Sure. I happen to think some of them are legitimate. But again, it's one thing for a researcher to think that they're true. It's another thing for an intransigent, officially sanctioned culture to acknowledge. Until that happens, a guy like myself is just, talking into the wind.
Right. Okay, so we know that you've spoken about the secrecy iceberg. What are the secret programs about?
Well, they're about a number of things. Certainly, first and foremost, I think we can say they are about attempting to replicate or understand the flying discs, flying saucers, that have been the object of interest by the military. In other words, the first and most important program has been to replicate a flying saucer. There's actually a pretty reasonably good amount of evidence for that. This is something that I did go over in my Amsterdam lecture, which is on YouTube. In short, we've got a combination of good firsthand accounts of people who have been present at crash retrievals of UFOs. We have good, reasonable enough testimony from journalists, professional journalists, who've had Groom Lake contacts, that is in Nevada, who've discussed breakthroughs in technology that are Star Wars and beyond. And we have a couple of eyewitness accounts of reliable eyewitness accounts, I should say, of objects that are clearly our own and are clearly doing maneuvers that are beyond any kind of aerodynamic thing. So I think there's a very strong case to be made that over the last few decades, the U.S. has been developing for all intents and purposes, flying saucer technology. But that's not the only part of the program. Another element of the program would be to conduct biotech research. After all, if you've got non-human bodies, presumably from another planet that you are studying, well, that's a gold mine in terms of biotech information there. We've had a smaller number of leaks over the years that have discussed this, but a few. And I think that they're certainly suggestive that we've got a clandestine biotech program. Another element would be, as we started this discussion, a secret space program. And think of it this way. There is a number of witnesses, one man that I spoke to in great detail, that gave me reason to believe that there are bases, crazy as it sounds, on the far side of the moon, and that there are true anomalies worth investigating even on Mars. Now, if there are, just roll with me here for a second, if there are anomalies on the moon or on Mars, And if we were part of a program that was dealing with the UFO phenomenon, would we not want to investigate those anomalies? And if so, we would certainly want to do it beyond the prying eyes of the rest of the world. So we would need a secret space program, if for no other reason than to look into these anomalies and conduct our own investigation. And I think that's part of what's been going on.
But do you think the Russians or the Chinese have similar programs?
Well, what I do think is that over the past 40-plus years, the UFO cover-up has become a very international kind of operation and has really gone beyond the policy of any one nation, and that includes beyond the policy of the U.S. You know, look at U.S. policy. This is easier for a non-U.S. citizen to see, I think, than for most Americans. And you can see that it is blatantly controlled by international financial interests. The U.S. invasion of Iraq was conducted for no other reason than to take about $30 trillion worth of oil out of the Iraqi ground and pass it off to multinational investors who now own that oil. So in other words, what you could really easily argue is that the U.S. military has become really nothing more than a police force for international financial groups. It's not a military working on behalf of American national interests, not in the least. Same holds true with Afghanistan. If we wanted to go into this, we could really take this to a very sophisticated degree.
Mm-hmm.
The point is simply, though, that the U.S. military is working for someone else. Now, who is that someone else? That's the thing that I am constantly asking myself. I mean, the specifics. Yes, we can say multinational, upper 1% of the upper 1% of the 1% financial groups. Yes, but who specifically are these people? And I don't know all of their names, or I wouldn't presume. Not yet. But I do think that it's financial groups like that which have predominant control over these clandestine programs through the auspices of primarily the U.S. black budget world. But it doesn't mean that Russians have no interest. There's probably Russian money that's gotten its way into it. There may be clandestine Russian programs. It may be that the Chinese are starting to develop their own capabilities here. But without a doubt, look, the U.S. black budget structure is where the action has been at for years. In terms of money, in terms of weaponry, you know, look, writ large, the U.S. military still to this day, despite the relative decline of the U.S. economy, the U.S. military is still more powerful than that of several other, the next few militaries combined. And I think so that within the black budget world dealing with UFOs, almost certainly the U.S. military structure is the police force used to deal with this phenomenon, if you follow me.
Yeah.
So, but that doesn't mean that the U.S. president has operational control over it. In fact, I think that he probably doesn't.
I would agree with that.
I don't know who does.
The Chinese were talking about in the next 2 or 3 years, they're looking to go to the moon.
Yes, that's exactly right. And, you know, what does that mean? the question is, what does it mean for the rest of us? Will they go to the moon and will they play ball with the U.S., let's say the U.S.-led cover-up, or will they not play ball with that? That's really a great question. I spoke to a gentleman who was very much involved in the remote viewing program in the U.S., in the 1970s and 80s, who told me explicitly that in the early 80s, one of his jobs was to go to Fort Meade, Maryland, and that's the headquarters of the U.S. National Security Agency. And his job was to train remote viewers whose job would be to remote view the far side of the moon. And I said, trying to act innocent, well, why would they do that? He said, well, why do you think? I said, well, were they looking for E.T.? He said, yes, they were going to be looking for E.T. I asked, did they find E.T.? And he said, well, I don't know.
Yes, I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know, exactly, right. But I do believe him that was his job, And you're not going to be training remote viewers idly.
Are we talking about Ingo Swann?
No, actually, the man who told me that was Russell Targ.
Oh, Russell, okay.
Russell Targ, who, along with Hal Puthoff, developed the protocols in the 1970s at Stanford Research Institute to study remote viewing. I met Ingo Swann a number of years ago. In fact, I spent an evening in his home. A very brilliant man, and one of the great remote viewers of modern history, of course.
Yeah. Hal says he was numero uno. He was number one. Ingo Swann.
Well, he was extraordinary. The stories about what Ingo Swann was able to do are just astonishing, truly astonishing. Back in 1972, I think, when somehow Ingo, who's an artist in New York City, I don't remember exactly how he learned about the startup operation. This was a CIA-sponsored, funded thing for Stanford Research Institute.
Yep, fully admitted now.
Yeah. Oh, I think they might have actually put out a small ad, believe it or not, looking for people. I'm trying to remember how that worked. Anyway, someone told Ingo about this and said, you should do it. You're great at this. And he wrote to Hal Puthoff and essentially said, well, I'm your man. So Puthoff flew him out to SRI, and this is 1972, meeting with a bevy of highly skeptical scientists about all of this. And they took him to, I think it was the fourth or fifth floor of this building.
Yeah.
And Puthoff standing there, and these other guys are standing there, and the grad students are there. And this one scientist says, in the basement of this building is an object known as a magnetometer. Its job is to measure quarks. Yep. He says, what I would like you to do is to perturb the device. Perturb it, affect it. And Ingo's answer was, well, I'll try. So he sits down in this chair, and as he's getting himself into the groove, so to speak, he begins to see the device in his mind. And he said at that moment, the grad student who was monitoring the device on the fourth floor said, whoa, stop everything. There's something wrong here with the device. There's a problem. The needle was going wildly, apparently. And he smiled. And they did this several times. And essentially every time that Ingo Swann was able to see this device in his mind, the inside of it, they had to stop the experiment because they said there was a malfunction. Well, some skeptical scientists are just never, ever going to be convinced of anything. Puthoff, to his credit, was very intrigued and continued experimenting with him. And they just took it from there. They did so many incredible, incredible remote viewing experiments. I got so interested in this about a decade ago. I interviewed Hal Puthoff about this. I interviewed Ingo. I interviewed Joe McMonagle, another great remote viewer, Lynn Buchanan, and a few others. And I tried at that time to write a paper on what I thought would be the science of remote viewing or the physics of remote viewing. In other words, just asking myself, how is it possible in this reality of ours, space and time, for a human being to see not only across space, but across time, because some of these remote viewers were seeing things that had not yet happened.
Yep.
What does it say about the nature of space and time? And I will add that it was that study of mine, this is back in 02, 03, that really was instrumental in opening me up personally to some of the more bizarre things that the UFO phenomenon offers. I mean, after all, once your idea of space and time gets broken down, and remote viewing will do that if you really get into it, then a lot of other things become fair game.
Exactly. So let's talk a little bit about the concept of a breakaway civilization.
Sure. This is something that I've been working on for a few years now. Think of it as like the ordinary classified world, but maybe on steroids. So in other words, let's go back in time to the 1940s, and we'll pretend that we're part of the clique that has had access to Roswell technology, let's just say. So we've got a lot of brilliant minds working on this with a lot of money, a tremendous amount of secrecy and security in our world here to study these highly exotic objects and these things. So certainly we would make some breakthroughs and probably have some really good money-making ideas in that process, maybe better integrated circuits or lasers or fiber optics maybe or superconductivity. For all I know, and from what we've been told through various leaks, official and otherwise.
Colonel Corso.
Philip Corso, I was thinking of, as well as a few individuals that I've spoken to have said essentially the same thing to me. So we've got your money-making opportunities here, and that by itself would reduce your incentive to less than zero for giving this secret up, obviously, right? But let's take it a step further and say that maybe we made some other really neat breakthroughs, like a new source of energy, something that didn't require petroleum, or some form of electrogravitics. So whether we made a Tesla tech breakthrough or something else that would be a real game changer, I guarantee you that would not necessarily be shared readily with the outside world, because those would be some of these things could really take down our largest industry, or possibly our largest industry, which is the petroleum industry, on which the entire modern financial structure has rested since 1859, basically, and which is not going to come down without a struggle, without a fight from the people at the very top of our hierarchy. And these, of course, are the people who dominate U.S. and every other national policy imaginable.
Right.
And their answer would be, well, that's a really nice breakthrough, guys, but we're not going to let that one out. What we want you to do is continue to work on that privately and see where you end up. And that's what we would do. So maybe we developed electrogravitics in the 1960s, but we keep working on that privately. Now, here's where a breakaway civilization comes in. I ask myself, what is a civilization? What constitutes a distinct civilization? It's not the easiest thing to know for sure. It's not easily quantifiable, but we can say that civilization is partly defined on its level of technology, its basic understanding of science, its cosmology, that is, the idea of where these people fit into the larger universe, I think we can say is part of a civilization, and as well as maybe social interactions among the people that inhabit it and their relations with outsiders. Mm-hmm. All of these would be things that would help define a civilization. Well, when I really think about this clandestine world, this is a world that scientifically, you have one key breakthrough that's held back from the rest of the world that can easily lead to another breakthrough. Science works like that. One key development can lead the way to something else, which in turn can lead the way to something else, and so on and so on. The next thing you know, these people can be decades and generations, maybe, dare I say, centuries ahead of the rest of us. It's not such a crazy thought. I spoke to a scientist who had worked at the NSA in the mid-60s who told me that at that time, circa 1964-65, NSA's leading computers had a clock speed of 650 megahertz. Now, that's nothing today, but that was not a clock speed reached by the consumer market until around the year 2000, 35 years later. So on that basis, the NSA was 35 years ahead of the rest of the world. So now you take an example of an organization that's got Roswell Tech to play with. Well, where might they be? We have no idea. But they could be in a place scientifically, technologically, so far beyond us that the rest of us poor slobs on the outside, up topside, would not have the slightest clue. And that these people within this classified world could be considered a separate civilization, one that has broken away from our own, hence a breakaway civilization. And that's the basic idea. It was an idea that I introduced in the second volume of my study, UFOs and the National Security State. I expanded it a little further in a book that I co-authored a little over a year ago with my colleague and friend Bryce Zabel, and that book's called AD After Disclosure. It's a concept that I can't prove yet, but I do think it's a logical concept, and I think that it's probably true.
Okay. Tom?
Yeah. How familiar are you with the smart metal or the memory metal?
Yeah. That's called nitinol, I believe. I'm trying – this is off the top of my head. Well, it's this is something that seems to have been developed, or could very well have been developed, in direct response to the Roswell crash. There have been a few other.
I would say pretty much 100% would not be, because it was done. It was done by a company that was just across from the Bates in Ohio.
Memorial Institute, correct. And I'm very glad you brought this up, the Roswell crash, of course, happened in July of 1947, and the Battelle Memorial Institute, which was very much involved in studying UFOs on behalf of the Air Force, was involved in the development of this of nitinol, and that's memory metal. So I think it's a very good connection,
That's a very close one compared to, we were always talking about, the metal that, it was found and, was bent and...
Yeah, I think I'm very glad you brought that up, and I should have brought that up previously in my own chat with you guys, but yes, I think that memory metal is very important, is a key link. Also, my friend Dr. Bob Wood has looked into this quite a bit as well, and it's his opinion that the transistor has a probable relationship. Not that the Roswell crash, the Roswell object had transistors per se, but that transistors, the idea of transistors came out of study of the Roswell event. I don't really have access to his detailed paper on that, but that's his opinion.
Yeah, there's
he looked at labs as behind all of that.
Yeah, there's lots of information out there on technology that has been referenced to its invention connected to crashed UFOs, and of course, what you're going to be trying to do is figure this stuff out. I look at it this way. Imagine you have a job in the below top secret world, even in the top secret world where you're working on projects, you're working in a lab, you love your job, and you're a person who just loves to fiddle with technology, and somebody approaches you and gets you into a program working on alien tech and trying to figure it out. Now, right. You would wonder, why wouldn't this person eventually come out and talk about it? Well, they love their job. They get to play with the best toys in the world. This is better toys than they've ever played with in their entire life. They get paid really, really well, and they get to play with the best toys. And the people that they can communicate with are only the people that would understand what they're saying on a technical level. In other words, there's all kinds of different trades out there. Lawyers talking, lawyers speak to other lawyers. You want to have a conversation with me? Don't talk lawyer speak. We're not going to have a conversation.
Yeah, very good point. And not only that, but these guys who are involved in the program are pre-screened to the max. So there's background checks being done all the time. They wouldn't pick a guy or a gal who would seem to be a security risk anyway. So the people who are brought into the program are already going to be predisposed, at least in the opinion of the managers, to secrecy, to being team players and all of that. So you've got great incentives financially and in terms of the culture that they become part of. And then there's also great threats. Let's never forget. There are threats, as Edgar Mitchell said to me, threats to one's family for giving up some information that's not supposed to be given up. I don't know how else one can interpret that except, literal bodily harm. If it goes that far, I wouldn't be shocked. Certainly, in terms of one's career and profession, those are usually more than sufficient to keep someone quiet.
Yeah.
Right up until the very end of their life.
Right. I mean, I'm not saying that people don't come out and speak about this. Yes, we have witnesses in the past, in the field, who have come out and spoken about it. I'm not talking about that. I'm just talking about the outlook of, hey, you know what? My life is great. Why would I want to screw with it?
And most people, look, most folks are not, they don't live their life to fight the power, to rage against the machine. They just want to have a nice life. They just want to do their thing. They're not out to be Superman. And so they find that they're in this situation. Yeah, they're not going to talk. How many cases have I come across of people in military families where Grandpa or Uncle Joe, you know, they know he has got secrets, whether they're related to aliens or not, and he takes it to his grave. It happens all the time. There are people, they're deeply patriotic. They become deeply indoctrinated into their clique, and it's been deeply internalized. Never talk. And a few do break down. And there are always those cases of older fellows who will occasionally, you know, talk to a trusted family member, but by and large they don't talk, and so that's just another part of the situation we have to deal with.
Right. Plus, there's also the possibility of them having to deal with ridicule. Is it worth the ridicule they would have to deal with?
Most definitely. You know, any politician, you know, just 4 years ago here in the States, the Democratic Party had their primaries. This is when, of course, Barack Obama ended up winning that. But in the early goings, one of our Democratic candidates is Dennis Kucinich, who, as I think many listeners may be aware now, Dennis Kucinich was and is a personal friend of Shirley MacLaine, the actress, and back in the early 1980s was at her home on one occasion. She wasn't present, but there were two other people who were with Dennis Kucinich, and all of them saw a triangular UFO over her property. And Kucinich said to them that he felt that this thing communicated with him telepathically. Now, that is the most typical thing that UFO witnesses will say. I mean, I just said to you earlier in this interview that I didn't get a telepathic message, but I felt somehow that thing was in my head. But Kucinich felt, and I'm sure he genuinely did, that this thing somehow communicated with him. So he has his experience. And what happens? Shirley MacLaine writes her memoirs and essentially outed his experience. She wrote about it. And here's this guy. He's already got the whole, you know, world stacked against him because he's a liberal Democrat trying to run for president. Now he's got this UFO experience, and he's got to deal with it. And it came up at the presidential primary debate in 2008. And poor Dennis Kucinich, everyone chuckled, everyone laughed when the whole experience was brought up. And he tried to defend it. He said, look, I don't know what it was, but I saw it. But he didn't come off well on it. And, you know, if he needed his ship to be sunk, if it hadn't been sunk rather by then, well, that certainly did it in. And his candidacy was dead in the water. I mean, he was, in other words, touching the UFO issue is the third rail of American politics. It's the third rail of politics around the world. No one wants this issue. No one knows what to do with it. Especially in the U.S., the pressure is so intense on the political elite who are working hard to become even higher up in the elite structure. This is a topic that no one broaches. It is the true elephant in the living room that no one cares to discuss, even though it's right there.
Mm-hmm. And this would lead into the disclosure project and the trying to get the And when you wrote about AD after disclosure, that would be after that would take place.
Yeah.
Now, were you talking specifically about a political disclosure, which means, you know, within the governmental system, they come out and say, okay, you know, we've been knowing about this since 1947 and previous to that, and we just thought we'd come out and tell you now you're ready, you can accept it. Or is it an event-driven instance?
Yeah, well, it's let me try to make this as clear as I can. I believe in the value of a political disclosure on the reality of UFOs. There are some people who think that it's, you know, who cares what the politicians think? We know it's true. I get that at a certain level. But I'm also a believer in the concept of government being responsive to the will of the people. And when we have a situation going year after year after year in which on this very important matter the government is not responsive to the will of the people, it's a symptom, one of several, of the decline, indeed really serious decline, of the democratic health of that society. So we need for a healthy, vibrant, democratic system, we need responsiveness from the government on this important issue, which has been so instrumental not simply in the creation of our black budget world, which needs much greater examination, but which is just so revolutionary in scientific implications, social implications, and everything else. So we need that. Now, how will it come? I do not believe, I have never believed, that any government agency will ever willingly disclose this reality. First of all, I don't believe that most of them have any access to it. That includes the president. I don't think that the president any longer has genuine access to this topic. In other words, what's happened is that I think it's been hijacked by private, or let's say quasi-private, quasi-public entities that seem to be independent of presidential authority. So I don't see any political initiative ever voluntarily forming that will disclose the reality of UFOs. Never have, never will. What I do see, however, is that there are three major players in this game. You've got the secret keepers, who, again, have no incentive for giving this up. You've got the other beings. Let's not forget them. They are part of this equation. And then the other part of the equation is us, our society, we the people. Look, we as a society have been going through the most incredible revolution, technologically primarily, but also in terms of social change. And indeed, let us say, a change in our mind. You can say a change in our consciousness, if you want to go there. And think about where we were as a world a mere 20 years ago, to say nothing of 30 to 40 to 50 years ago. The changes have been dramatic in terms of our ability to have a global communication, a conversation about almost anything. So we're not going to stay in a 2012 holding pattern. Obviously, there's going to be a 2020. There's going to be a 2030. I ask myself, what kinds of technological infrastructure will exist in 2030 that may be game changers in the whole structure of secrecy? For instance, look at something like WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks they have been kind of quiet over the last year, it's true, but that's not going to be forever. But you look at what WikiLeaks has done in its brief history, and it's been an incredible force for revealing secrets in this world. Well, WikiLeaks didn't exist even 10 years ago. And the reason it didn't exist 10 years ago is because it couldn't exist 10 years ago, because there was no true global technological infrastructure. So that once the capability arose, here was an organization that was able to make use of it. There will be other breakthroughs, I guarantee. If there's one thing I'm sure of, is that we're going to have new opportunities that arise in the next decade and two decades and three decades. Computing power, one example. We're going to be having computers. By every expert who's been talking about this, it is said, in another generation or less, your computer will be talking to you as a sentient being. Whether you think it's sentient or not will be irrelevant, because it will seem like it, but it won't need to sleep. It'll have a relative IQ of several hundred points. Yeah. It'll be like a genius, and we're going to have a whole bunch of them. I mean, what? I can't even imagine what our world would be like in such a context. And then developments like quantum computing and advanced nanotech. There are going to be, in other words, possibilities for us to extract this secret that don't yet exist. And in that context, I ask myself, do I really think we're not going to have any true headway in another generation or two in breaking the secret down than we do now? I just can't see that. I think we will.
Do you think that there's going to be a fallout? Like, if we go back to the Brookings report.
It'll be tremendous. I mean, so the thing is, you know, the society is pushing this, and what will be the trigger, I do not know. Whether it will be a leak, whether it will be a mass sighting that is somehow multiply recorded and quantified in some way, I don't know. But I believe something will force the powers that be into making an admission. They'll never do it voluntarily. So when they make an admission, one thing that you can be sure of is that they will lie and spin to their heart's content so that they maintain maximum control over this. But the problem will be, once this topic is legitimately out in public discourse as something that can be discussed, it seems to me it's going to be very difficult to control it, because then suddenly a lot of other voices will be able to come into this. Void, people who are formerly in the alternative media like ourselves and many others are going to jump in. And look, it's not that hard to do the basic research, and we'll be able to put two and two together, and it's going to lead to many other questions. One will be, how have you kept this secret all these years? There's some blowback for you. Manipulation over the political discourse, the mainstream media will come under greater scrutiny. There'll be a tremendous amount of basically, we're going to see a revolution in three stages. Stage one will be all of the institutions that are, some of which will crumble, some of which will survive, that will be affected by the blowback. That'll include financial changes in our scientific paradigms, our spiritual slash religious paradigms will very likely be part of those changes. Not that they won't all just go by the boards, but they will certainly be affected. Culture. Guarantee what we'll see is a kind of a 1960s times 20, because it'll be the 60s attitude of don't trust anyone who's, you know, part of that system. There'll be a lot of people who are going to opt out, who are going to you know, accept this new reality. They'll, in fact, they'll be experimenting with all kinds of hallucinogenics like ayahuasca or DMT to break up.
We're seeing that now, and I think we've seen the Occupy Wall Street movement.
We are, and I think any kind of disclosure will be that amplified many, many times. So there'll be this great rift, this great divide culturally. The second level of revolution will be a kind of a geopolitical revolution, because after all, it's going to be obvious that the nations of the world are going to need to coordinate a little bit better to meet this challenge. Whatever this, whether it's a threat or even cooperation, it's a challenge. And we're going to need to cooperate to transition away from a petroleum-based global economy. Because obviously, a 10-year-old can tell you that whatever these objects use to get around from point A to point B, it's not petroleum. Therefore, there's a solution in the UFO phenomenon that leaves petroleum out. And what that means is you're going to have a global situation that can't just be done haphazardly. I just can't see that as being a wise move. And there'll also be the dangers of weaponization of technologies.
Right.
Forget this. If there's free energy around the corner, well, that's a wonderful thing in a way, and it's a really scary thing in a way. Ask yourself, you know, human beings aren't simply going to ascend to the next dimension and become good people all of a sudden. Human beings are scary, violent creatures. And some people, if you give them free energy, they'll happily heat their home for free for the rest of their lives, and they won't bother anyone. Other people, maybe not so much. What if the technology implicit in the UFO science is such that it could destroy the Pacific Ocean, right?
Yeah.
And if that's so, then geopolitically, whether people like this or not, it's going to be necessary to exert some form of global control over the dispensation of that technology so that it doesn't blow us all up. And believe me, the last thing that I'm doing is trying to be an apologist for a global system. Now, but I believe that can be done the right way as opposed to the wrong way. The wrong way is what's happening now, which is mass privatization of global resources, so that basically you have a small clique of people owning all the stuff in the world. What we really need to have in the aftermath of disclosure is a kind of global federalism, let's say, in which nations retain their sovereignty and their rights, but also we have to learn to coordinate globally in a more effective and in a more democratic way. I don't have the magical answer for that. But I do know that there are examples in this. And I look at the history of my own country. The United States in its first 50 years was a really remarkably successful experiment in federalism. When these 13 colonies got their independence from Britain, they were essentially a confederacy. And the attitude was, hey, we didn't fight against the King of England to have a King of America. We're independent. Virginia is its own thing. Massachusetts is its own thing, and so on. Well, that was about to fail real fast, real badly. Each of these nations had their own states had their own currency. They had their own tariff policies. It was going to fail. And right. The solution was a federal system in which the states retained some rights, but some power went to a federal government. And it was really the only viable solution. We are now globally, if you look around, okay, at the globe as a whole, I would suggest that in many ways we're in an analogous situation. You got U.S., Canada, China, Europe. We are all so interdependent on each other. We couldn't opt out of the system if we wanted to. It's not possible. Mm-hmm. We have to understand that that's the reality. So what I believe is that stage two of the revolution will be a geopolitical revolution. And the opportunity, as well as the danger, is there. The opportunity, well, the danger is that the global leadership will simply work to create a global police state, simply squash down on all of us, chip us all, monitor us all, control us all, and it can happen. It can happen. But there is an opportunity. There's an opportunity for great men and great women to be visionaries and to see that here is a chance to side with the people, not with the elite, not with the Illuminati, not with the Bilderbergers, whatever you want to call them. It doesn't have to be. And there can be an opportunity. And that was one of the main points in concluding AD after disclosure that I wanted to hammer home, is that there can be a better way. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but I felt that I would be remiss if I didn't try to point a direction that it could be. And then there'll be a third stage of a revolution, and I didn't write about this in AD, but I am writing about this currently in my next book. And I think the third stage of revolution will be one of human, I'm almost afraid of the word consciousness, but let's say of human consciousness. And this third stage of the revolution will be one in which I think the aftermath of all of this tumult that will happen after disclosure will result in a radically different way that human beings understand themselves and their world. And that will include, for starters, the recognition that there are these other beings that are here, for better or for worse, but also the recognition that the human mind and the human spirit has capabilities that we have really denied to ourselves for most of our history. And I think that is a real possibility, that we'll be seeing that down the road. So I remain somewhat of an optimist. At least I try to be an optimist in certain moments. I do think that we've got a chance for some a good future, but I'm not a utopian. I'll never be a utopian. In other words, I do not believe that disclosure or whatever you want to look at, 2012, or that we're going to have the ability to solve all of our problems.
Right.
No matter what happens, we have a world with massive environmental problems that we have brought on, and it will take centuries for those problems to go away. So even under the best of circumstances, if we cleaned up our act right now, we would still have centuries of remediation ahead of us in terms of the global system. We got species that are disappearing at such an alarming rate. We're eating away all of the world's fish, essentially.
Mm.
We're causing the effect known as coral bleaching, and which is causing deaths of huge parts of the ocean. We've got issues here, and all of those have to be dealt with. But nonetheless, I believe that there will be this third revolution. That will be a revolution of the mind.
Right, and I think people are getting getting pretty sick of the whole, you know, Fukushima type events. That if you look at this in retrospect, knowing what we know or what we research, let's say it that way, mm-hmm. is that there's been a holding pattern put on the technology that we as a people have access to, that this could have been avoided, but for the purposes of greed and manipulation, it was not avoided. And I hearken back to the time that Nikola Tesla walked into J.P. Morgan's office and said, I have this, you know, this thing, and here's what we're going to do. And J.P. Morgan said, where do I put a meter on that? And right. We all know what happened to that.
Well, absolutely. You know, that's a story that when I started in this journey almost two decades ago, I knew about Tesla, but I certainly was no Tesla maven or even expert in any way. The more we look at that story and Tesla's work in general, it's very, very clear that he had a real solution there. Now, it's never been clear to me, because I've tried to understand this scientifically, and I'm not a trained scientist, so it's difficult. But I've tried to get an idea of how effective, truly, Tesla's energy generation concepts were. And I want to be able to conclude that, yes, they are very, very effective, and they may be. But I've also not been totally convinced of this through the scientific literature that I've encountered. I'm not saying that it's impossible that it couldn't solve all of our energy problems. But there have been scientific arguments against, the Tesla coil as as the solution. So whether he really had it or not, I still don't know. But I leave open the possibility that he did. Certainly, Morgan didn't have an easy way to monetize Tesla's ideas, and that was, as you say, the end of it.
Yeah, and that was a problem. That was what I was trying to get at. And this, what I've talked about previously on the show is species planetary evolution. And if you follow species mm-hmm. planetary evolution, there could be multiple events in Earth's past when, you know, civilizations have, I mean, we do have this, they've grown and fallen and grown and fallen. But I think eventually it follows a line. And if you impede that line, you put a block on it, it's sort of held back. And I think that's sort of the holding pattern we're in. And we're just, there's, because of the connection globally between people, advent of the internet,
right.
That makes that blockade that much more difficult to maintain.
Yes, I think that's very well said. I agree with everything you've said there. We've been in an enforced adolescence, a forced holding pattern. Our future has been held hostage, is another way to look at this. And the development of the web, I really think, was maybe not something that was foreseen even by the masters of our universe before it happened. I think understanding the full implications of what has happened, I don't know who could have really understood that. I remember the world of, say, 1980 and 1985, and man, oh man, what a long, long distance indeed that world is from even a decade later. To say nothing of two decades later, the world really went through a fundamental shift, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s, toward this global digitization. And it's been a game changer. It's been the game changer. And it's the revolution that keeps on going, because it's not just the web. Now it's portable devices and smartphones and iPads. And soon it will be implantable devices, probably into our brain, nano devices, for good and for ill. They certainly can be used by companies like Verichip to monitor you and control you even. They can also be used, in theory, to enhance one's intelligence and to connect to the web mentally. So who knows where we're going to be in another 20 years in terms of our capabilities as a society to talk to each other. And the real question, the real issue that's on the table right now is it's the battle between the brick wall and the sea that's coming in. And we, the people, are the sea, and will that wall hold, or will we overwhelm that wall?
But we know what happens when water encounters rock. Water wins.
Sure does. And I tend to think that we're the water in this equation, and that that change is inevitable. And we've gotten on to something that's a fundamental power, and I don't think we've fully grasped it all yet. But it's it doesn't matter. We're going in, and it's going to transform the world. My hope is that it transforms it for the better. I don't think it's going to be without serious problems, but I do think ultimately we've got a chance to make this world and our civilization a better place. I certainly hope so.
And I don't think that the Brookings report of the past reflects the current state of people's reaction to this.
I think
to
I
a large
agree.
Degree.
Yeah, I mean, Brookings report, this is from 1960. It was a study done at the dawn of the space age that NASA commissioned. And the conclusion was the stuff will hit the fan. People will freak out. There'll be a lot of panic, not just among ordinary people, but among our elites. Our scientific community will be very traumatized. I do think that a lot of that still will hold. We have had 50-plus years now of slow acculturation to the idea that there very well may be others that are here. But I don't know. I often think about, ordinary people. I mean, I got family. I meet with several times a year, and not all of them are on board with this topic, I can tell you. Not all of them want to be heroes, and not all of them are brave. There's a lot of people in this world who I feel are easily frightened still, and I don't necessarily think that a majority of the people will panic, but you don't really need a majority of the people to panic to have problems. You got 10% of the people panicking, and it can cause some interruptions in the infrastructure. In fact, Bryce Zabel and I wrote about that in AD a little bit. But yeah, I think I go back and forth as to how I think people will react. I think in general, look, people have to work. They still have to get up, take care of their kids, pay their mortgage, pay their rent, do their thing. They have to live. So you can only run around in circles pulling your hair out of your head for so long before you have to suck it up, get it together, and get on with your life. So on that level, yes, I think we'll deal with it. On another level, though, this is this disclosure, which I think will happen and will be forced, will be the opening salvo in a series of revolutions that are going to go probably for a full century. You know, think about the repercussions of something like the French Revolution, and that went for generations. This is a revolution that will go much longer and deeper than something like that.
I've said this in previous shows that I think that these things are just cycles. You can look at what happened during the French Revolution, the 60s movement. I think if we would have had the 60s movement and had the internet, it'd be all over. And you have Occupy movement now.
Right.
So I think they're just cycles. They keep sort of bubbling up to the surface and then spilling over the edge, and then they go down a bit and then they come back up again.
Well, it's certainly something that's not going to go away. I think something fundamental has happened in especially the last 10 years. I was just thinking about this in terms of my own country just today and yesterday. I think it was the presidency of George W. Bush that really permanently radicalized a certain portion of the American public. You know, when I wrote my first book, UFOs in the National Security State, that was the first volume, and that came out in the year 2000. It was the very end of the Clinton years. And when I look at that book, at the time that it came out, that was considered an extremely radical book in terms of its historical documentation of the UFO cover-up. Mm. I look back on that book now, and I still feel it's a good book, but radical? I don't know. There have been a number of studies through the first decade of the 20th century, that are much more radical in the depth of their political analysis than my book at that time went. Now, when I did my second volume, which came out in 2009, I was also much more deeply involved in analyzing the structure of secrecy. So I, along with everyone else, went along a certain path in the first 10 years of the 21st century. And I believe that that's really happened in large measure in my country as a reaction to the Bush presidency and the reaction to everything that happened after 9/11. So that a permanent radicalization, I think, has taken place in my country, not among the majority of the people, but actually among a larger and larger number of people. And the younger you go, the more you see it. And I don't think that's going to go away. So that voice is waiting, I think, for the right opportunity. And the Occupy movement seemed like it was the right moment, and now maybe not so much. I'm not sure. The book is not closed on the Occupy movement. You know, keep in mind we had winter here, and it did really make things difficult for those people.
Yeah.
You know, we got warmer weather coming, and that could pick right up. But the point is that much of the United States culture has already become radicalized and completely broken off from the mainstream. That's not done. That's just going to get bigger, I think.
Right. So, you were speaking about the evolution of your own outlook by looking back at your book and saying, thinking at the time it was, you know, really radical. Looking back at it now, saying, well, not so much really. You know, this is pretty much accepted stuff now. And this could be a blueprint or a template for if there is this massive disclosure or any of these other things we've been talking about, that everybody will go through this evolution of outlook where they go through the same sort of stages that you just spoke about.
Yeah, I think that's right. When I look at the UFO topic, I have gone through more paradigm shifts than I actually can count. I think of, you remember like in the movie The Matrix, where you have a choice to take the red pill or the blue pill, and our hero takes the red pill, and he takes it, and then he sees reality as it is. I wish it were that easy. I always wish it were that easy. Like one pill. If I just took one pill and had everything laid out, I would be happy. But no, it doesn't work like that for me. When you rip open your old paradigm, that doesn't mean, as I've learned, that you are now into your new paradigm. No, what it means is you're into your new paradigm that will hold for now, and it will hold for maybe 6 months, maybe a year, not much more than a year if you're me, because what happens is you investigate further, and then you think, oh, my God, and you rip open that, and now you're into a new reality, and that holds for a little while, and you learn other things, and you rip that veil open, and you step further again. I don't even know how many times I've ripped open my veil and gone into the next level, but it's been many. And that's a journey. I don't know the end of that journey for myself, but I can say that, yes, for those other people who have not studied this topic the way that we, the three of us talking here tonight, have, when the day comes that they are forced to confront this reality, they will have to go through many stages of reconstructing their reality and their paradigm. And some people will do a better job of it than others. I think the real change is always going to come not from people so much as from generations. I have two teenagers now that I'm raising, and I love being their dad. But one of the things that I see is how they very naturally grow up with attitudes that I've always had to work at to cultivate, but like They just grow up. To them, certain things are normal. And they have ideas now. They're at the ages now where they are really able to have fresh ideas that challenge me. And that's really where change comes from. Most of us, honestly, by the time we get to our 30s, I think most people are pretty much done in terms of formulating fresh ideas about the world. There are always exceptions. We can be exceptions. Listeners can be an exception. But I do think in general we find that people tend to shut down rather than open up as they get to a certain age. And that real change happens across generations. Disclosure, though, will force people against their desires to have to reinvent their worldview. And some will dive into it, and others probably not.
No, but I've actually had people say to me, I don't want to know about this. I'm happy. I live my life.
Yeah,
I love right. what I do. I just don't want to look into it because I'm happy knowing what I know.
Yeah, and look, you know what? I have sympathy for people like that. I do. I used to, when I was a younger guy, I'm going to be 50 next summer, man. When I was in my 20s, I was a little more strident about life in general. This is long before I got into UFOs. I was always a very maniacally dedicated student and young scholar. And I just thought, well, why don't you put in the effort that I put in to learn about the world? And what I realized is that, A, some people just don't have the desire to do it. They don't have the time to do it. Not everyone is gifted at doing the research and reinventing their worldview anyway. And the fact is that most people just have other things to do with their life, and they don't want their life to be complicated. They just want to do what they do.
Yeah. And more power to them.
Right. That's just how people are. And for me to presume that I know what's best for them, well, that's kind of arrogant on my part. So what I try to do simply is I'm available to people who want to talk to me about issues like this, and I will engage anyone who wants to. But I've long since passed a point in my life where I'll ever presume to judge someone because they choose not to engage in these issues. That's their choice. There may be a price to pay. All of us have a price to pay for all of the choices we make. I'm not immune to that. But someone who refuses to engage in this topic may be paying a price later by the kind of rigidity of mind that they've cultivated. They may be very unable to deal with the new reality that comes down the pike. Yeah. So that may be the case.
Yeah. Tom, do you have a question?
Yeah, Richard, I want to ask you, at the last conference that you had here in Toronto, we discussed more about the abduction phenomenon. I want to get your thoughts on that.
Yes, it's certainly one of the real keys, maybe the central key, for all I know, to the entire presence of these beings that are here interacting with us. You know, if you really look at the whole field of UFO studies, if I could be permitted to simplify for a moment, I often see two fundamentally different camps. On the one hand, you have researchers and people who really focus on these other beings as essentially positive and benign, who are here to assist us in our own species evolution, so to speak. And then on the other hand, you have people who focus on the possibility that these entities may not be in our best interest. And many of these individuals look at the abduction phenomenon as part of that evidence. So you've got the good ET and the bad ET camps, essentially. I'm not sure if I actually go along with the fact, I'm not sure I would agree that all abductions are necessarily not a benefit to people, as crazy as that sounds. But the fact is they are traumatic. People are experiencing what appear to be abduction phenomena by non-human entities, and it's messing some of these people up. They have no one to talk to. It's a kind of trauma that's the worst kind of trauma because, you know, if a woman has been raped or if a man has been taken and beaten, let's say, you know, at least you might have the opportunity eventually to talk to other people about it and to kind of have a cathartic experience in dealing with it. Alien abduction, who do you talk to? It's a very, very difficult, thing for people to deal with. And so they're encountering this phenomenon in an isolated, totally atomized way, and that's not healthy for a society. But in terms of abductions, what's actually happening? We really need to understand this completely. One question is, are they really even happening? There are people who argue that the abduction phenomenon isn't an actual real thing. I happen to think that it is. But it's still very difficult to nail down in terms of evidence. We can ask ourselves, are the abductors all human, or are they non-human, or are they both? In my own experience, I've looked into the abduction phenomenon independently and privately, and in fact, I'm still looking into it. I've got a number of particular cases that I've been studying. And it's strange. There's a lot of evidence to me that says that there are human players involved in this that are monitoring the process, that are aware of what's happening. And they may be doing, in fact, I think they do some of the abductions as well. So in other words, the entire, not all abductions are for the purpose of developing human-alien hybrids. Although I do think that is part of the abduction phenomenon. But there's a human part in this process. What I think is happening, my personal assessment, this is my guess, is that you've got human and non-human groups abducting certain types of people. And those people are being abducted because they have, there's something about them. Not simply their eggs and sperm, but rather their capabilities, their mind. In other words, what I'm saying is that my experience is telling me that many of the people being abducted are being abducted because they have psychic capabilities. They have something that is of value to these other beings, and they are, have a value to the black budget, black ops world that is also monitoring this whole process. My feeling from the cases that I've been looking into is that this could very well be a widespread or a much more widespread phenomenon than people might realize, that a lot of people are being taken. It's actually not as outrageous as you might think. The ability to manage human memory is very substantial within our own clandestine medical world. The ability exists to inhibit the formation of fresh memories. If you were to be taken out of your home, you could be given an injection that combined with hypnosis techniques could effectively prevent you from remembering what you were doing when you were taken and then deposited back to your room at 2 or 3 in the morning or 4 in the morning. You'd wake up, you know, extremely tired, feeling like, wow, I didn't sleep at all last night. But, hey, people have days like that, and then you get on through your day, you're kind of groggy, and you catch up on your sleep the next night. I think that's what happens. And I say that because I've looked into a number of cases where I'm pretty certain that that's been happening to people. So the abduction game is a very complex one. It involves non-human abductors, and it involves human abductors in a very complex scenario that I haven't yet gotten to the bottom of. But I think that has to do with the utilization of individuals with psychic capabilities, often without their full conscious knowledge. So it's a big part of it. And, yeah.
And I think that there's a, there's another element. I mean, there's also always the possibility that some of the people are making it up for whatever reason, whatever their motivation is. I don't know. I've handled an abduction case. Tom's handled hundreds of them. And it does fall into the, you know, weird category, you know. There was one I handled about 15 years ago that was just, it can only be put in the weird file because it was weird. It was strange. It was unusual. There was unusual aspects to it that I still to this day can't point at and say I've got an answer for, because I just don't.
Well, here's something that's weird. I've come across a number of cases in which the number 333 comes up, 3:33 a.m., again and again. Why? I don't have all the answers on this, but I do know for sure. I've had two cases in particular, very, very distant geographically from each other, in which these are both women who have woken up repeatedly many times at 3:33 a.m. One would have a constant connection to 3:33 p.m. In other words, every time she would just casually look up, it would be 3:33. She had a UFO sighting that had now I'm not an astrologer, I don't do that at all, but she does astrology, and in her way of explaining her sighting to me, it was a 3:33 sighting astrologically, and forgive me for not being able to explain that in better detail for you, but there are these odd connections to numbers and dates also, I think, that don't make sense outwardly, but that seem to be part of the pattern. And again, I don't know if I'll ever figure this out, but
yeah.
Tom's had
some cases that were just odd that have to go in the I don't know pile.
Well, look, they're
and
all
physical
odd.
Attributes as well.
I'm sorry, what, Tom?
Well, we've had a couple of situations. No, I said there was a couple of situations where there was physical attributes, physical evidence that was involved. And I'm not talking about, you know, the same, you know, old thing of implants and that sort of thing, but external.
Like body
physical
marks?
Physical evidence that
marks
occurred.
On the body, maybe?
Other elements, external elements of during the event.
Things left behind that were observed?
Yes.
Not only observed,
but on their bodies, actually.
And tested in a
chemicals,
lab.
Chemicals, things.
I'm not really getting what you're driving at.
Well, and
you'd have to hold
just,
tell
just
the whole
to put
story.
It,
sorry. Well, you mentioned it, not me. You're the one who got me.
You mentioned it, so I have to say it. Yeah. In one of the instances that I was involved, there was a young fellow who got up in the morning and complained to his mother that, you know, he had another one of these incidents, which of course his mother wasn't believing all along. She thought he was dreaming. He claimed that he, you know, when they took him in this place or this ship or whatever it was, he fought and he ran all over the place. And when they tried to put him through this, I guess what we would call like a cleansing or some kind of, you know, shower type thing, you know, where he ran all over the place and he fought them. And he was, you know, fighting them physically. So they just dropped him out. And when they dropped him out, I guess, whatever this chemical hadn't been cleaned or sterilized or whatever it was for, they dropped him as he was. And he just, you know, started yelling and screaming when he was back in his room and woke up his mother and the mother. So on him, on his body, on his pajamas, this orange kind of chemical or, you know, colorful
film
thing on him.
Yeah.
Yeah, like a, you know, like a stain or whatever you want to call it. Of course, you know, put him in the shower, cleaned him up, threw the pajamas and the, you know, to be washed. Didn't think much of it. Other than the fact that, you know, she thought maybe he went outside or something and rolled around, or, you know, in the middle of the night, because it was summertime. And it wasn't until actually later on in the evening when she was talking to a neighbor that the neighbor said, you know, maybe the kid is, you know, right in what he's saying. You know, maybe you should pay attention to him. Maybe try to call some of these folks that deal in this kind of stuff. And she ended up calling us. In the beginning, I sort of didn't know how to look at the situation, you know, because one of the funny things was that the grandmother of this child was a UFO contactee back in the 50s and 60s. She was very famous and dealt with politicians, and there was a big, you know, big brouhaha that went back down during that period. Okay. And so I sort of took it with a grain of salt.
Right.
We took the material, we tested it. Then about, I would say about, I don't know, 8-9 months or a year later, was involved with another case where this was here in Toronto. The young boy was out in Perth, which is sort of about halfway between Kingston and Toronto. And in this case, there was an older lady. She had seen some lights, you know, around her building, and that's how we got to meet her. And, you know, after speaking to her for numerous times, she revealed that, you know, she was having these type of, she called them dreams.
Yes.
Which was, you know, the usual abduction experiences.
Okay.
Anyway, she was very aggressive towards these beings as well, because she didn't like, you know, going through these experiences. And
right.
I had told her at the time that, you know, maybe an approach to take is to physically try to fight them, you know, when, if you were capable of doing that, you know, during the experience. And she ended up moving out of town. She went to Vancouver maybe a couple of months later. And maybe about a month later, I got a call from her, and she said, well, me and my husband, you know, because I remember him there that night, we had another one of these experiences, and I fought them.
Right? Yes.
And she was there's this strange thing that happened in the morning when, you know, or, you know, when she got up. They found these, you know, stains all over them, and they had it all over their, you know, their face, their body. And, you know, I asked her to take some samples and send them down to me. I didn't tell her anything about it, you know,
right,
any knowledge of a similar situation. And she sent the material, and it turned out to be the same.
Really? That's fascinating. I don't know if you've written this up anywhere, but I would love to.
I haven't, actually, because for the longest time we kept it under wraps because, you know, it's something that, you know,
was
hoping that I would come across again through some other researchers, but I haven't heard much of that.
Right, right. Again. Well, that is quite fascinating. Yeah, there's a definite connection there. There's a physical phenomenon. To what extent is it all physical, and to what extent is it non-physical is something that I think we'll be studying for quite some time still.
I totally
agree.
I think part of the problem is that, you know, all researchers are not working together. So if we had like a real collaboration of information, we would have been able to come closer to this. You know,
yeah, I totally agree. If we were working in a university, we would have offices down the hallway from each other. We could have lunch. We could be chatting on a much more regular basis. Now, I think it's starting to change a little bit more. We're all becoming a little bit better connected with each other. But I totally agree that you know, most research we don't share. There's still a certain amount of competitiveness that some researchers will have with others. There's no question that they'll hold their cases.
Most definitely.
And right. So, and on top of that, there's no research money really going into this. So everyone's doing this on their own dime. And that makes it difficult to make headway as well. And nonetheless, I think that there's been a lot of very good research over the last couple of decades. And I do think that what you've recounted is quite fascinating.
Well, I think we've covered, we're coming to the end of this show, and I think we've covered a great deal. What I would like to do now, though, is I would like to cover some information on your upcoming book, a link to your website, and And you have a you have a debate coming up in February that you want to talk about as well. So if you could throw that out there.
Sure, I can get into that all very quickly. I am doing a public internet radio debate, which I think really promises to be quite interesting, with Colonel John Alexander. A lot of people who follow this field know who he is. John Alexander has written a number of books. He's one of the nation's, one of the world's leading experts on non-lethal weapon technology, that is, weapons that won't necessarily kill you, but they will mess you up. He's written a lot about that. He's also had a long-standing interest in UFOs. He's a believer in UFOs, but his point is simply that there is no actual cover-up of the UFO phenomenon. His argument is that people who believe in a cover-up don't really understand how government works, that the governments are as mystified by this as anyone else, and he furthermore seems to deny the existence of a black budget special access type of component to this. So I'll be debating with him on that particular point. Is there a UFO cover-up or not? That's going to be on February 22nd, and it will be on Inception Radio Network, I believe. You can learn more about that. I'll have all of that information up on my website. My site is called keyholepublishing.com. It's like looking through a keyhole, keyholepublishing.com. Lots of information on that. If you forget that, just Google my name, Richard Dolan, and you'll find it. I do have a new book that I've been working on. I expect to have it out by the middle of 2012. It's called UFOs for the 21st Century Mind, and the subtitle is a primer on the greatest mystery of our time. And really, my intention for writing this book is that the field of UFO studies has been long in need of a fresh, fundamental reappraisal of what it's all about. I think this is long overdue, and I'm not saying I'm the only person who should be doing it, but I'm putting my hand in it, and I want to bring this field up to date truly for the 21st century. And what that means simply is that that means an appreciation of the long history of this phenomenon. It also means an appreciation of the deep aspects of the cover-up, an appreciation for the truly weird elements of the phenomenon itself. That includes abduction, includes encounters of all types, the mutilation phenomenon, the crop circle phenomenon, the fact that there seems to be a powerful mental connection between us and them in some way. What does all of that mean? The future, the end of secrecy, the fight for disclosure and beyond, how all of this will play out, and all of these themes I'll be covering in this book, UFOs for the 21st Century Mind. And most of it's finished. I'd say about three-quarters are done, and I expect to have the book out by the middle of 2012 at the latest. That's an exciting project. In addition to the two volumes of history I've written, UFOs in a National Security State, there will be a third volume that'll come out after I finish this current book. So I keep myself busy.
Yeah, that's great. I'd like to thank you for coming onto the show. I appreciate your time. I know you're a busy man. And thanks, Tom, for those great questions. And we'll catch you guys next week.
Next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.